call the meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee together. And it looks like we're missing some of our committee members, but we have a full agenda date. We're going to get started. We're going to hear from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and then also from the Minnesota Housing Partnership. And it should be a good meeting. And I guess we'll start without a quorum here and then come back to that later. So I'd like to welcome Commissioner Tingerthal, I believe, and whoever you're bringing with you. There she is. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good.
Yeah.
They're coming.
28, 7. Not quite. We have 8. Well, actually, before the commissioner gets started, we do have a quorum, so maybe we can approve the minutes first. And I Representative Moran, you're sitting there. I think you might have had a chance to check out the minutes.
So moved.
So moved. Okay, they are moved for approval. Any discussion on the minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is approved and the minutes are adopted. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. I know you're going to talk with us about the governor's budget and anything else, right? Overview. Thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead and start.
And for the record, I'm Mary Tingerthal, Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I want to thank the committee for inviting me back again. We were here about a week and a half ago giving you a little bit of background on the agency and the scope of what we do. And today we're very pleased to do an overview presentation on what was contained in the governor's budget and to try to show you a little bit about how that fits into our overall strategy of affordable housing for Minnesotans and to get a chance to answer your questions. So you should have in front of you a PowerPoint presentation that I'll walk through. There are also a couple of other handouts. One is just a detailed sheet with the budget, but the numbers are a little larger than they are in the PowerPoint, so they're a little easier to see. If it's all right with the chair, if people have questions in the moment, I'm happy to take them.
Sure, that's fine.
Through the chair. So if it just is best to answer the question while we're on the thought, I'm happy to take them as we go along. Great. So as we reviewed at the last time I was here, our mission at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is to finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. And we really do mean that in the context of fostering strong communities. We're not just a bank that makes loans willy-nilly. We do try to make it in concert with communities and with developers and social service agencies that work in those communities. And I think you'll see that theme spread throughout our presentation. I also neglected to introduce the person at my left, and that is Tanya Orr, who is our Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development at the agency. Going on to page 3, once again, our strategic priorities are 5. We just did redo our strategic plan last year, focusing on successful home ownership, preserving federally assisted rental housing, addressing rental housing needs in specific markets, preventing and ending homelessness, and finally preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery as a result of foreclosures. Going on to page 4, just a recap of what we'll be talking about in the next few minutes. We'll first present the governor's proposed budget for the agency. We'll start with some new budget initiatives that the governor's proposed and then review the base budget program areas. We'll then spend a little bit of time talking about where we have provided housing assistance in the past And finally, give you a few highlights of program impact from past programs. For slide number five, you may want to refer to the other handout that you received, which is a summary of the budget. Along the left side, you'll see the different program names, and in just a moment, we'll be going through what each of those programs means and what it does. You'll see the fiscal year 12-13 base budget, which we are currently operating under. And next column is the proposed base budget for fiscal year 14 and 15. You will see that there are really only two changes, and I'll go over those in detail as we go through the sections. And those are in the fifth line item down, the preservation line item, and in the rehab loans item, the second from the bottom. It's essentially a shift of dollars between those two, and then a slight adjustment to the rental rehab deferred loans. The next column indicates the programs into which the governor's initiative dollars would flow should they be funded. The next column is the combination of those last two, totaling an overall budget of just over $89 million for the biennium. And finally, it shows the increases in the two main items where the initiatives would be added and the overall percentage increase in the overall budget. So we can kind of use this as reference as we go through the individual line items. I do want to point out that within the governor's three proposed initiatives, there is actually an initiative for the Housing Finance Agency within each of the governor's strong priority areas. The first is his commitment to a strong economy. The second is a commitment to Minnesota's students. And the third is a commitment to government reform. I'll now go through each of those. On page six, we first talk about the recommended initiative having to do with housing and job growth, the investment in strong economy. The recommendation is for a one-time $10 million investment into our challenge fund. And out of that initiative, we would expect between 175 and 200 units of housing to be developed. It is intended to support business expansion efforts, primarily, although not exclusively, in Greater Minnesota, where communities are really stretched for being able to afford to provide housing at all, and particularly to be able to provide affordable housing. We have a number of examples of places that I have personally visited. And next week, the governor and I and several others will be attending a meeting in Roseau, where one of the employers there, Polaris, is exploring whether there's actually enough housing in Roseau to support an expansion of their business there or whether they will need to look elsewhere. The point of the challenge program when it was created some 10, 12 years ago was that a requirement of the program is that at least 50% of the challenge program funds must be used in projects where there at least is some contribution from a non-state resource. So it really is intended to be a challenge both to employers and to communities to say, if the state is going to bring dollars to promote affordable housing projects in your community, we need you to step to the table as well. The expected outcomes would be new affordable housing in job growth areas and employer investment in that housing. If we take a look at the next page, this is a very preliminary map. But we wanted to give you some idea of the types of communities from which we may receive proposals that could be funded by this initiative if this initiative were to be funded in the overall budget for the year. Moving on to the second initiative on page 8, This represents the governor's recommendation for housing in support of his overall investment strategy for Minnesota students. It would provide a one-time $2 million investment that would provide rental assistance for families that experience high mobility in their lives. What that means is often they don't have any form of housing subsidy, they don't live in a subsidized apartment, and therefore they often have a hard time affording the housing that they're in. So they may be in an apartment for a couple of months only to find out that the market rate rent that they're paying is just digging too deep a hole into their monthly budget. Or they may find that they're living in housing where they may be able to afford the rent, but it's not very safe or sound housing, and they may find that the living conditions simply are not acceptable. What we've seen a number of studies show is that housing stability is really a key to strong school performance for kids. And we've also shown in a number of programs that rental assistance to the families of those kids actually can contribute to housing stability. So they have a way to afford the housing, they can afford to stay in one place and not have the kids move from place to place. We also have studies that show that students that that move frequently tend to have lower school attendance rates, even though the schools are required to provide transportation for kids that have suffered homelessness. Even that amount of movement can be very destabilizing. So, interestingly, not only do we hope through this initiative to improve school attendance and to improve, hopefully, school performance, but there would also be a savings from the schools in terms of transportation costs, because they would no longer have to get kids from place to place as they are required by federal law. This I would characterize as really a pilot program. We are proposing this as one-time funding. It would serve 115 to 135 families, so multiply by two or three kids, you know, maybe upwards as many as 500 kids. And we intend to really seek some assistance from the foundation community to study the impact of this rental assistance so we can demonstrate whether this really is the cost-benefit equation that we predict it will be. Moving on to page 9. We go to the third of the governor's initiatives, and that is his initiative that supports the government reform.
Excuse me, Commissioner,
strategy.
I believe there's a question from Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a quick question on this, the program for students. I just did a quick math job, $2 million divided by 125 families. That's about $16,000 per family. What kind of housing are you looking for that kind of money?
Would you introduce yourself?
Chair, Representative Anderson. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. That's a biennial figure. We're assuming that it will provide up to 24 months of rental assistance, and it's a monthly cost of about $600 a family. So it's what we've experienced as an average for families, and it would. Families would not have to rent units that are at the HUD fair market rent, so they're not going to be able to go out and rent the, you know, the penthouse.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I wasn't sure if you were waiting for the commissioner to finish or not, but
no, go ahead.
I just very quickly on this, and I do have another question, but I'll wait till later to ask that question. Actually, this isn't even a question. It's just a quick observation since we're on this issue. You know, in the last year, I've interacted with the Department of Ed looking at their student data outcome sets, and it really, I have to say, it's really quite compelling that when you break out highly mobile students, regardless of race, The student outcome disparities are incredibly huge. You have, and unfortunately also a pretty large, at least in the last few years, a large growing universe of students. You can almost eliminate, you know, half of the achievement gap in our state just by factoring out the highly mobile students that are found within those different communities when compared to other stable or other students in stable environments. So this is a pretty big deal for us to be able to, as a state, to get our hands around providing stable environments so that kids are not moving, and sometimes three, you know, four times in a school year, from one location to another. And so I hope that something like this can go forward, and I'm really anxious to see what kind of results this may produce for us.
Very good.
Thank you. That was an important testimony from the education chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to slide number 9.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. Representative Fisher, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. Going to slide number 8, I noticed that the governor's proposal in the budget is to serve 115 to 135 families. Knowing how many people are experiencing homelessness and are at risk, What is the real need out there? I know this is not the entire need. Do you have any figures as to what the real numbers are that run into this on a regular basis?
Commissioner?
Yes, Representative, Madam Chair. One way that we can get a handle on that is how many children were transported under the federal requirement last year, and that was 2,603 students for a transportation cost, let alone the achievement gap cost, of nearly $5 million.
Okay. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I applaud the governor's budget that we're getting something started in this area, but as we take a look at it, so what we're looking at is we're still going to be serving just a very small fraction of people who really need it then, correct?
Representative Fisher, Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Although if you multiply the 135 by 2, you're maybe at about 10% of that 2,600. So it's at least, I think, a meaningful experiment. And, you know, I think that the agency has a relatively strong track record of taking pilot projects like this, actually putting some research behind them, and then bringing them back to the legislature with some results and letting you evaluate the evidence.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And returning to page number 9. This next initiative has some similarities to the one we just discussed, and that is it is also a rental assistance program. This one is for ex-offenders, so for those who have served their time in our correctional facilities and are now exiting to remake their lives. And here, again, I would characterize it as a pilot program. We think we'll be able to serve between 75 and 90 individuals. We have learned from talking with a number of service providers, as well as the Department of Corrections, that lack of stable housing is one of 5 primary factors that influence recidivism. To say that the Corrections Department of Corrections is excited about this initiative would be an understatement. And we are already in discussions with them that if this initiative were to be funded, just how they would go about identifying those ex-offenders that might be at highest risk of recidivism for this reason. One of the other things that we've learned in talking about this initiative from some of the providers is that one of the things that happens with these ex-offenders when they're able to have stable housing is that it gives them an opportunity often to be reconnected with their families, often with their kids, and that reconnection often gives them the inspiration to really turn things around. Just the opportunity to have a good, safe place to have your kids come and visit really does let you reconnect with that family and give you a reason to turn your life around. So I don't know, I was pretty compelled by some of the discussions we had, and I'm really very hopeful that this initiative will be funded. Just on the
there's a question on that if you're still okay. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. I know that there's an MSOP task force working right now on some recommendations about what to do with that program. Is this? I know they haven't come to their conclusions yet, and they're still working on that. Did this come from some of that, or is this just on its own?
Translate the MSOP for the rest of the committee.
The Minnesota Sex Offender Program, Madam Chair. Thank you,
Chair Representative Schumacher. It didn't come out of the that group, although the agency participated last fall or the fall before that in a day-long retreat about this particular issue of how to house the sexual predators. Some of the people who may benefit from this might be sexual predators, but it's not specifically intended for that group.
Thank you. I think maybe ask the same. Well, maybe Representative Isaacson, you might ask the question that I was going to ask. Go ahead.
Fisher,
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. this would be a question for our testifiers. As I see that there'll be extra people that'll be serving. One of the questions I have is on support services. I know you're talking about the housing component, and I know that for many of the folks to be successful, they need to have the wraparound support services. Is that covered elsewhere, or is there already capacity in the system to take care of that so that we ensure that we've got great successes coming out, or is that a missing component?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, we recognize that there will be a need for support services. With respect to the highly mobile students, we hope to challenge the philanthropic community to help us with the service dollars. With respect to the ex-offenders, the Department of Corrections and the county have services available. They're often waiting lists, and so the Department of Corrections is thinking that one of the benefits of having a longer-term rental assistance is that people will be stably housed while they're sort of waiting to get through the waiting list for services, and that sort of critical first few months will be very helpful so that they can continue to be stable while they're waiting for the services.
Representative Fisher.
Follow-up. So as I understand then, if I'm understanding you correctly then, is that it seems that they're supporting services for the addressing with the recidivism issue, but there is not any identified sources for the support services for the student area, and that's where there's a challenge that you're trying to figure out a way to match it. So we do have a gap in that area that needs to be addressed creatively.
Yes, sir.
That's correct.
And I think I was going to maybe build on the question you had asked earlier, Representative Fisher, just again the need versus what we're looking at trying to address. Do you have any idea of those numbers, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, in fiscal year 2012, about 7,600 adults were released from prison to supervised release parole. So, again, certainly not meeting all of the need, but as we have been in conversations with the Department of Corrections, they really do have some very strong ideas about who is at greatest risk of that can be mitigated by the stable housing. So we'll really be targeting the funds to those where we think it will make the biggest difference.
And Commissioner, I know there's been some excellent programs out there right now that are working with these offenders, and the cost savings are pretty amazing, and it's the kind of thing that, again, the return on investment might be a really important figure. I don't know if you have that in hand right now, if you could say anything about that, and if not,
right,
we can come back to it.
If we can go back to slide number 9 for a minute, just a comparison, maybe not a return on investment, but a comparison. The cost to house an offender for a year in prison is over $31,000. Rental assistance for that same time period is $5,500 to $7,000. That doesn't, of course, include the services, but even if you, you know, double that amount to account for services, you're still well below the cost to have somebody show up back in prison.
All right. Thank you. Sure. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Realizing that there's never enough funding to provide all the help we would like to provide, just have to ask about a priority of, you know, this money could be used to help families as well. What about the discussion of where this money should be placed and who would it help better with this in mind?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, certainly that is always a challenge for this committee and for the governor. I think what we've recognized by administering a rental assistance program, which we'll talk about in just a minute in our core funding, we recognize that there really are many vulnerable populations. And, for example, in some cases, if you do have an ex-offender that successfully reenters society, gets a job, they may reunite with their family and really in the end create a less vulnerable family because they may go back to having two wage earners, whatever. And so, you know, we try to balance the variety of needs. I'm sure we don't always get it right, but we do recognize that, you know, there are many needs across the board.
Thank you.
All right. So that concludes our section on the governor's three budget initiatives. We move on then in, on slide number 10 to discussing the base budget program areas. There are 6 different areas and 9 different programs, and this is a place where you might want to follow along with the budget sheet that we also handed out. In the first sort of general category area, development and redevelopment. So here we're talking building or rehabilitating single-family, multifamily housing. Our primary funding program is the Challenge Program. And this is where the base budget is at $13.9 million. We'll go into more detail on each of these. Our supportive housing and homeless prevention programs, there are 3 different programs. The Housing Trust Fund, which is essentially a rental assistance program. Bridges, which is specifically a rental assistance program for those with mental illness. And Family Homeless Prevention Assistance, which is a program of very small grants to families, literally to keep them from becoming homeless by providing things like security deposits and first month's rent. Our home ownership assistance is to provide opportunities for those who are able to buy a home. Rental preservation and rehabilitation is our preservation affordable rental investment fund. Homeowner rehabilitation, that's single family owner occupied homes, is our rehab loan program. And finally, a couple of small programs for resident and organizational support. Includes our counseling program and our capacity building programs for nonprofit organizations. Moving on to page 11, we'll go into a little bit more detail on the Challenge Program. And again, this is the base budget, but this is the budget category into which the $10 million initiative would also go. Most of the dollars in this program are awarded through a competitive process. You may recall from my previous presentation that many of the dollars that come, the appropriated dollars that come to the agency, are awarded through an annual request for proposals process. We typically see between 3 and 4 times as many applications for this program as we are able to fund. So it's even with last year when we awarded more than $134 million worth of various assistance, we still were able, we still had to turn away many viable projects. This program provides workforce housing in Minnesota, and what does workforce mean? It would be in greater Minnesota up to about 59,000, and in the metro area up to about 66,000, and I think that's for a family of four. In the last year alone, this is not biennium, but just the last year, we did we provided funding for 958 housing units. This is one of our biggest opportunities to leverage scarce state dollars. Over the years, about $7.5 of non-state money is leveraged for every single dollar that comes out of state appropriations. So this is one where we really, really make those state dollars work very hard. And it is used predominantly by private developers, that's both for-profit and nonprofit, who will own and manage the housing over the long term, and is also accessed by housing authorities that may own various types of housing. Questions on the Challenge Fund? Okay. Our next category is supportive housing and homelessness prevention. And there we have three programs. The Housing Trust Fund is the largest of those programs, a little over $19 million for the biennium. And in last year alone, we served about 1,900 households. This is a program that in the statute, we're allowed to use these dollars either for bricks and mortar or for rental assistance or operating subsidies for the buildings. And in the early years of the Housing Trust Fund, back in the early 2000s, dollars were often used for bricks and mortar. But as we've gotten more and more supportive housing units built, we anticipate that 100% of these dollars would be likely to go for ongoing rental assistance for the units that have all been already been built and identified. Not that they would be the same people, but that they would remain with those same units. Our second program I mentioned earlier is the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program. This program is administered by a variety of social service agencies, counties, community action agencies around the state. And it totals almost $15 million, with almost 7,800 households served just last year alone. This, again, is, I think, just a tremendous example of where you truly can prevent a family having to spend time in a homeless shelter with a very few number of dollars. This has been proven again and again, both at the state level and with federal dollars, to really be a very cost-effective program. Much like keeping people out of emergency rooms, this keeps people out of emergency shelters. The Bridges program, which also has been long running with the agency, we work very, very closely with the Department of Human Services in identifying those who suffer from mental illness that need rental assistance on an ongoing basis. The next bullet I always think is just a bit startling, and that is that the median annual income of the households that utilize these programs is $9,000 a year. We really are helping the poorest of the poor with these very important programs. And again, these are all programs that are delivered by local organizations that are selected by the agency in a competitive process. We work together with the Department of Human Services and many of the counties to select those organizations and make sure that they are achieving the kinds of outcomes that are expected from these dollars.
Okay. Commissioner, I do have a question. Certainly this is one of the areas where, you know, I think, what do we have, something like 12,000 homeless people tonight. out there. And so we're, the need is really much greater than we've been able to give you dollars to deal with over the years. I'm just wondering, you know, maybe you could even break it down a little bit by the different programs, a little bit more about what the need is in each of those arenas. Do you have that information, or could you get it to us?
I think that's something, Madam Chair, that we will need to get back to you on a by-program basis.
Okay, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to page 13, our Homeownership Assistance Fund. This is one of the longest-running programs with the agency. It was originally funded back in 1975. And again, we don't have the indication here, but this is a program that's used side by side with the money that we raise through the sale of tax-exempt revenue bonds. We assisted last year to the tune of about $250 million worth of mortgages for first-time home buyers, and the down payment assistance is provided to the lowest income of those eligible home buyers. It really is, I think of this very much as a bridge program that people that may have stabilized their lives and their housing in rental housing, this is really the kind of the next step for them. And in many cases, it's very hard for low-income families to save up a down payment, and increasingly, it's hard for families to save up enough to pay the closing costs. That might be a mortgage guarantee premium, it might be the origination fee for the mortgage, et cetera, and those numbers have been creeping up. Last year alone, just 1 year of the biennium, we served over 1,400 households with this source. And the median annual income of households served is a little over $44,000. And one of the things that we're really quite proud of in Minnesota is that we have colleague agencies around the country, and most of them provide some form of down payment assistance. We have, for many years, been the number one agency in terms of the lowest income households that we serve with this program. So we really are targeting these funds to those who have enough money to afford a mortgage. I don't want to give you that impression that we're funding people who shouldn't be getting into mortgages, but are really at the lowest end of that spectrum. This is a program that is originated, again, in the communities. It's originated by banks, financial institutions, mortgage lenders, and is really at the fabric of the community. The Rental Preservation and Rehabilitation Program, some of you may remember from our last presentation that I talked about the fact that in Minnesota we have over 40,000 units of rental housing that currently receive rental subsidies through the federal government, either through the Department of Housing and Urban Development or the Department of the Rural Development Department through the USDA. Most of those properties were built between the mid-1970s and the mid-1980s. So one thing that they have in common with the baby boomers is that they're all getting old at the same time. And what we've learned is that if we ever lose one of these properties because a building owner is able to convert it to market rate, or because we let it deteriorate physically, those rental subsidies are gone forever. At the federal level, the housing policy has been, probably for at least the last 10 years, that while the federal government continues to support the units that they have contracts for, if those contracts go away, those rental assistance units go away. They're not creating any more project-based rental assistance. And so we think of these as just an incredibly valuable existing resource, and that it's very cost effective for the state of Minnesota in order to keep getting those rental subsidies to preserve these units. We found that we are able to preserve almost $5 in federal assistance for every dollar that we put into preserving one of these properties. We've recently been doing a lot of work with our existing portfolio, identifying the criteria by which we will prioritize the projects that will be eligible to receive these dollars. One of the other, the final bullet on this actually refers to one of the line items on your chart, and that is the preservation line item. You'll see that we're proposing for the base, the base in 12-13 was $14,626,000. We're proposing that that actually be reduced to $8,437,000, and most of those dollars are being moved down to the rehab loan line. The reason for that is one of the few sort of new dollars that we have coming in from HUD is through the federal so-called home program. And those dollars, I would just say, are relatively compliance heavy, meaning there's a lot of reporting and a lot of things that have to be complied with. We have found that the most cost-effective way to utilize those dollars is to put them into buildings that already have a lot of federal compliance. So we're kind of piggybacking the compliance rather than loading it onto another program. So we will be shifting home dollars from funding single-family rehab loans up to funding these major preservation projects. It's just better all the way around and much easier to make sure that we're in compliance. So just wanted to explain the reason for that change.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the area you were talking about, the federally assisted housing units in Minnesota, you've mentioned we have 40,000. I'm glad that we're doing the preservation there. I'm wondering, even with those efforts, are we losing any of the housing units right now, and what kind of loss is that on a regular basis? Do we have any knowledge? Are we able to keep, are we able to preserve everything we have?
Yeah. Representative Fisher, Madam Chair, we don't believe that we lost any projects last year. There is a requirement of the federal government that we or the city in which they're located be notified when a project is when an owner intends to leave the program. So we actually have an opportunity to react. So that notification provision is actually quite valuable. And last year, we're not aware of any that went out of the program. We're actually working with a property now that is being foreclosed by HUD that we're working to transfer it to a new owner, so therefore not losing the property.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, just on that point, not only, you know, is a subsidy lost, my understanding the other great difficulty would be to try to rebuild any of a similar kind of structure. The cost would be so many more times magnified. I don't know if you have any comparisons that you have at the top of your head there, but I know that that's another reason why we don't want to let those buildings deteriorate or disappear.
Madam Chair, I know that that is a number that we do have, and we will report with that back to the committee, but it is dramatically more cost-effective to preserve these units. And just so the committee knows, when we preserve the units, i.e. when we put dollars into a unit, we only do that in exchange for the owner agreeing to extend the period of time that they will keep their Section 8 contract in place. And we put some real teeth into those agreements. And so that, you know, if we get another 20 years out of the improvements we make, and you compare that to building the most cost-efficient new construction project, it's many times more cost-effective, and we will get you that number.
And Commissioner, I think another good point might be to indicate how these are distributed statewide. I know that's something that you're pretty proud of, that these resources are statewide, and you know, if you have a map of that, that might be helpful too.
Madam Chair, we certainly can provide that, and it really is a point of pride in many communities that these are buildings that the community leaders know and actually like to have in their communities, because they're often the place where you know, the widows off the farm and the disabled folks in town are living. So they're very, very important to particularly our rural fabric.
Thank you.
Moving on to page 15, our homeowner rehabilitation program. This is the program that the legislature funded back in 1975 that actually brought me to the Housing Finance Agency for my first round. This is a program where we are serving very, very low-income homeowners, many of them elderly. More than a third of them are elderly. And it addresses very, very basic needs for a lot of that aging housing stock that's located both in the metro area and throughout greater Minnesota. We have a real focus on health and safety improvements, energy efficiency improvements, and increasingly for elderly families, accessibility improvements, so improvements that allow them to stay in their homes longer by providing grab bars, improving the accessibility of bathrooms, doorways, etc. We typically are able to serve only 600 households in a biennium. With this program, it's not very much money. We administer this program, again, through community action agencies and housing redevelopment authorities. They often use it in conjunction with federal weatherization programs. So we, even this program that serves the lowest income, we really try to leverage the state dollars with other dollars that are available. This is a program where we regularly run out of money before we run out of year, and that is the case again this year. Finally, moving on to slide number 16, two final programs, our Homeowner Education Counseling and Training Program, known affectionately in the community as HECAT, and here the budget is for about $1.5 million. I think I mentioned during my previous testimony that we work through a network of counseling organizations that gives us probably the only state in the union that truly has statewide coverage for counseling. Most of these dollars are currently being used for home buyer counseling, that is counseling before people buy their properties. And the reason for that is that we've been fortunate to use that same network of counseling agencies to successfully compete for federal dollars, which is what we've been using for foreclosure prevention counseling. So it's nice to have a network where when we needed it to do foreclosure prevention counseling, we already had that network largely in place. What we find about home buyer counseling, which is this is focused on, is that it really is a very important critical factor in successful home ownership. And one of the things that we're particularly excited about is that the statewide network of counselors was selected by the Department of Agriculture to develop an online version of home buyer counseling. It is an interactive learning system that provides ongoing testing throughout the classes, and they were even thoughtful enough to design it so that it runs over a regular phone line. It doesn't need a lot of bandwidth, so you can even probably get it in Halleck. And that's something that is just being rolled out this year. I was a little dubious when I first got involved with the project, but I've seen the results, and it really is quite impressive. So trying to use these dollars very effectively so that people who live in Marshall County don't have to rely on the one home buyer counseling or home buyer training session that might be offered in a whole year and have it be on the same day as their kids' basketball tournament and they have to miss it. So we think we've really seen some nice innovation from the groups that utilize these dollars. And capacity building is a really very small amount of money, but very, very important. One of the primary uses we make of those dollars is to help organizations around the state which are called continuums of care, which are the organizations that do the planning and program selection for a variety of federal dollars that serve homeless families. And in order to get those federal dollars, these consortium of care that really don't have a source of administration at all have to put together a fairly complicated application. And what this does is provide some dollars that allow them to make some modest use of consultants, et cetera, to help them put together those very important applications. In closing, we've just got a few final slides. On page 17, I talked about this during my previous testimony, but I did want to remind you that the state appropriations that you will have a chance to vote on represent really a very small proportion of the overall budget for the agency. That is about 9% and allows us to leverage federal funds and bond proceeds many times over. Moving on to page 18, the regional distribution of assistance. We talked about this also during my previous testimony, that we do not have a strict allocation plan for the dollars, but because we have a competitive process every year, we do over time see really a very fair distribution of resources around the state. In any one year, it might shift a little bit to one region or another, but over a period of 5 years, if you looked at it, you'd see a very fair distribution of resources.
Representative Mariani, did you have a question?
On page 19, I won't go over these numbers, but these are just some of the highlights, some of the numbers to carry with you about the types of families that we are assisting. On page 20, I'll just wrap up my comments by reminding the committee that Minnesota Housing has a 40-year track record of success. We have enjoyed bipartisan support over that entire 40-year track record. We also use that money very wisely in terms of keeping our access to those federal funds that make up such a large portion of our spending budget for programs. I mentioned that at the last presentation that we are able to retain a AA1, AA+ credit rating, which allows us in turn to lend to homeowners or to rental property owners at the most competitive rates. We think that that's a good bargain. Also remind you that no state appropriations are used for the operating expenses of the agencies. So every appropriated dollars goes directly into programs. We do make investments in communities all over the state, and we do that not with state employees, but through local businesses. So lenders, social service agencies, private developers, and private property managers. Investments in virtually every program leverage both private and public resources. We recognize, as we talked about earlier during our discussion about the rental assistance programs, that we see many savings because of our ability to provide supportive housing, particularly. And the state appropriations, although a small percentage of the dollars that we put on the street every year, are really vital to serving, making sure that those dollars go to low and moderate income Minnesotans. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think the chairs are just kind of consistently getting lower in this room with every passing. Thank you, Representative Anderson. My knees are up to my chin. Anyway.
To work on that.
Well, first, you know, I just want to commend the department, and we obviously heard your testimony earlier. And it's good to see the budget continues what I think is a pretty mature logic and a pretty effective logic for our state in Minnesota. And I'm sure I'm not going to capture all the elements here, Madam Chair, but obviously, you know, being present with rental assistance and putting that within the context of helping to stabilize communities, understanding, you know, the multiple negative effects that unstable communities have relative to housing, impacting economics and schooling, education, et cetera. And obviously, a part of that is stabilizing home ownership as well, and then doing it in a way where you're working pretty intimately with communities all around the state, and doing that in a way where they're maximizing federal dollars, as we talked about a week ago, where they're, you know, able to, we're able to recycle, you know, that influx of federal monies to continue to be effective in our state. So I'm really glad to see that that logic, you know, continues to hold. And then obviously the budget also is attempting to kind of stretch a little bit in terms of continue to respond to some real pressing issues in Minnesota and how housing touches on that. Having said all that big stuff, I'm going to focus on a very tiny little piece, and it might be in the capacity building. I think it was, Madam Chair, at one point. And full disclosure, my wife, who works for a nonprofit housing counseling organization, is also a member of a nonprofit land trust organization in St. Paul, Madam Chair, the Rondell Land Trust, which I think might be the oldest or one of the oldest land trusts in the state. And we tend to think of land trust activities as more greater Minnesota focused, and I know there's a strong, you know, use of them in greater Minnesota, but they're also very effective in the urban core. It's one of the ways, one of the few ways in which we can provide affordable housing ownership for people, again, by removing that, you know, the cost of the land. I'm just wondering, obviously it's a small piece. I have probably three or four properties in my district that are land trust properties. So I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit about where in this good and big budget, if at all, those kind of activities can be supported. I think at one time, Madam Chair, we used to do some kind of capacity mm-hmm. sustaining investments to further these land trust efforts. So anyway, I'm just sort of reaching around here and obviously responding to something that's present in my district and that I'm seeing as having a real positive impact in providing affordable housing for affordable home ownership for low-income people.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I'm really delighted to talk about community land trusts.
Right.
2 years ago, shortly after I took on this position, I was invited to speak to a national meeting of community land trusts from all over the country that happened to be meeting in Minneapolis. And to say that they were blown away by the level of program support that we provide to community land trusts in Minnesota would not be an exaggeration. And so let me enumerate the ways in which we are able to support community land trusts and do so both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. In fact, I would say probably even more in the metro area than in greater Minnesota. The primary resource over the years that the community land trusts have accessed is the Challenge Fund. We have kind of a sub-program under our Challenge Fund that we refer to as CRV, Community Revitalization. And it's also a competitive process, and many of the land trusts access those dollars successfully on a year-after-year basis. We also provide a source of mortgages when houses are sold, which is something, quite frankly, that very few housing finance agencies do around the country. And then third, and very exciting, last year when the legislature saw fit to provide us with housing infrastructure bonds, We were able to utilize a portion of those housing infrastructure bonds. I believe it was about $2.5 million for the purchase of land by the land trusts. That is an allowable single-family activity under the tax-exempt bond laws. You can't actually build the house with those dollars, but you can buy the land. And I would say that's probably a first in the country kind of initiative that we were able to fund last year. So last year, not only did the Community Land Trust have access to the challenge dollars, they also had access to the housing infrastructure bond proceeds. I would also say that I've been excited that the Community Land Trusts in Minnesota have shown some real leadership in being part of a pilot program nationally for some innovative software that makes it easier for community land trusts and similar programs to actually run their programs on an ongoing basis. I happen to have just seen a presentation last week of a group in Duluth called One Roof that was a pilot demonstrator in this program, and I have to say it was really quite stunningly impressive. It's a software that was developed with some assistance from the Ford Foundation, and one that I hope other community land trusts will be able to access over the next several years. So we're very signed on for the work that community land trusts are able to do in promoting very affordable home ownership.
And Madam Chair, thank you for that. And I can certainly see, particularly that last, I'll have to look up the Duluth Group software project, might get at one of my or might help with one of my concerns. But this is true of my concerns of a lot of small, you know, nonprofits out there that are doing good, and that has to do with their ability to meet their administrative overhead costs. Is there anything that we have in within MHFA that assists with that? You mentioned the Ford Foundation. I know that from my wife. I hear that. I know that, you know, they're very aggressively, assertively looking for, you know, private sector, corporate, you know, philanthropic, you know, support. I also run a nonprofit in a whole nother arena, and that's a pretty rough environment nowadays. And so the point, Madam Chair, obviously, is that if we're fulfilling a good public good here, definitely welcome the investment from the private sector to help meet those operating costs. But on the other hand, if there's any ability for state, public and federal sources to help that, then that seems like a wise thing for us to do. So anyway, if you can just maybe share a little bit, if there is or if there's any thought to ever providing any kind of similar support for these small, and I take it all of them are probably pretty small entities around the state.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the primary way in which we support the operating of organizations like community land trusts is through allowing them to charge an administrative fee when they receive an award from the Challenge Fund. And so there's a tendency because of that, as it is with many federal programs as well, that if you get on a good roll of writing successful applications year after year, you tend to be able to build up a bit more of a dependable funding stream. And, you know, I have to say, having also worked for a number of nonprofits in my career, that, you know, typically that's a good start, but often it does have to be matched with philanthropic dollars on an ongoing basis. But I would say, compared to work that I've done with nonprofits from other parts of the country, being able to bring to the table the fact that you're earning a certain level of dollars from ongoing programs that you can access through the state, being able to take that to the foundation community and say, hey, you know, we've got a great track record and we need a match.
Thank you. Thank
you. Last question, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I just have to ask this. I'm from the west central part of the state, and realizing our population is much more sparse out there than other areas. Your slide on page 18, 1.8% of the overall share doesn't seem real equitably distributed. There is a need out there. Could you talk about that area seemingly having less of a share of the overall pie?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, in looking at the map, it's important to remember that we're really showing two things with the little pies. The blue is the share of assistance, and the red is the share of lower income cost burden households. One of the things that happens in the parts of the state that have a very low percentage of the overall population is that in any given 1 year, it can be the difference between one project getting funded or not funded that will really swing those dollars pretty wildly. And just to give you an example, the share of the need, if you will, for West Central is at about 3.5% of the state. So the cost-burdened households, 3.5% of the cost-burdened households in the state live in the West Central region. In 2011, there were 3% of the dollars went into that area. 2012, 1.8%. But over the last 6 years, 2007 to 2011, it was actually 4.5%. So it's been a little lagging. I know that there was a large organization, the West Central Housing Partnership, that has struggled, and I think I'm hopeful that we'll be able to work with that area to get some new applicants, because it really is kind of driven from having good, solid local partners who are able to put proposals together. We did have a meeting out in Fergus Falls last spring, and I know there are folks thinking about it, but haven't quite pulled that together yet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner. And we have another presentation today, so we'll end with your presentation, but please feel free to contact the commissioner, and we'll be seeing that budget in the form of a bill pretty soon, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
And then there'll be lots more chance for discussion.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. While the Minnesota Housing Partnership folks are coming down, let me just make a couple of quick announcements. Next Wednesday, we will be having Representative Freiberg's bill, House File 83, I believe it is, that. Right, here before the committee, and we will have some amendments that will go out at least 24 hours ahead of time. Let people know about that. So if you have amendments that you want to that bill, please get them in on time. Also, the committee is trying to plan for a tour on the we'll take a van out, and we're going to tour some of the properties around and look at deal with foreclosure, with homelessness, and we think that's going to be on Tuesday the 19th. At about 5, leaving, or 5:30? Wait a minute, what time are we leaving? Leaving about 5:30. I just want to ask committee members to put that on your calendar, to think about whether or not you can go on that. And we'll have some box lunches on the van and so on, so that we'll tour a number of places. And we're open to some considerations if you have specific ideas about that. Anyway, I guess what I want to do is welcome you to the committee, and I'm sorry, I have a little bit less time than I thought we'd have for you, but please feel free to use it all, and maybe if we need to have you back, we will. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, my name is Julie Johnson. I am the Public Policy and Outreach Coordinator for the Minnesota Housing Partnership. We began in 1987 as an informal coalition organizing community groups and nonprofit developers to play an active role in affordable housing, and we are still at it today. Our mission is to promote Homes for All Minnesotans and to assist Minnesota communities in the creation and preservation of housing affordable to low and moderate income people. Some of you are very familiar with our advocacy work as well as our policy research. Each of you should have recently received county profiles describing the housing and homeless needs in your district, and this is what it looks like. We are also a member of the Homes for All Alliance, and we are here today to talk about this work. Now I'm going to hand the microphone over to Bill Vanderwall, the capacity building manager, who has been helping communities in Northwest Minnesota respond to their workforce housing needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vanderwall, for coming back again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. Thank you as well for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Bill Vanderwall, and I'm the capacity building manager for Minnesota Housing Partnership. Julie mentioned our work at MHP, and I'm kind of the part of our organization work in that area that provides technical assistance to organizations, to communities across Minnesota, greater Minnesota, and really across the nation in many of our different kinds of technical assistance projects that we do. And we're always working to ensure in those communities that we work in that there's going to be an adequate supply of decent, affordable housing for everyone. So I'm here to really support the Housing and Job Growth Initiative included in Governor Dayton's budget. You went through the presentation that we heard, and this is the $10 million one-time appropriation really targeted for areas where there's job growth and a lack of affordable housing, particularly for workers in those where those jobs are growing. So I'd like to just take a few minutes to tell you about my experience in the last couple of years, really about a year and a half, of providing some support and assistance up in northwestern Minnesota. We, as an organization, helped to fund two housing studies, one in the Thief River Falls greater area and another in Roseau County and the communities that are within the county. The goal of those studies was to sort of research what their housing situation is currently, and what they would project their future needs to be in terms of housing. It includes all kinds of rental housing that they would have, home ownership housing, senior housing, really the whole spectrum of housing needs across these communities. And as part of that work, Minnesota Housing Partnership has also supported them to take the data that comes out of a housing study and then engage in a planning process that engages people across the community to understand what came out of that study, what is the data that came out of it, and then also to do some planning around what can we do in our community to address those needs. What can we have to do some prioritizing, be strategic about that. So essentially we end up kind of creating a kind of a strategic housing plan, if you will, on what kind of housing they would like to see developed, created, and supported in those communities. So I've been actively working in that area in that way for the past year and a half in Thief River Falls, really starting about a little over a year ago there. And in the Roseau area, excuse me, about 5 months into that one as we speak. So we've got teams in each of those areas that represent the communities, their cities, county government, elected officials. We have business representatives, people from the community, social service agencies, housing agencies, etc. Really have participated in these planning processes. And so we've got a really nice broad base of people at the table supporting the planning and prioritizing what they like to do in terms of these needs. So in each team, we've examined the study. We've kind of deliberated about the facts that are in there. What does it mean in our particular situation? The employers can weigh in and say, yeah, situation. The employers can weigh in and say, yeah, I think it really captured where we're at, except it didn't really talk enough about growth that we might have. Or there might be some other factors that people around the table would know so we can influence that prioritizing and strategic thinking. We've assigned some tasks and timelines and begin to work towards implementation. So I think there's a handout that you have that just sort of, I took some of the data that came out of those housing studies. I believe you all have it, am I correct? Mm-hmm. And I'm not just going to kind of read off of this, but I thought I'd just pick a few kind of key things to tell about what is going on in these communities, and then just sort of talk a little bit more about what we've come up with in those planning efforts, and then open up for questions if you'd like. In terms of the Thief River Falls area, this really covered what they call the Thief River Falls market area. It's the city of Thief River Falls, but also includes 14 cities, and touches four counties. Pennington is the main county that Thief River Falls is located in. About 75% of the housing there is homeownership. About 25% is rental. And right now, they've got, as of this study's date, which was in 2012, late 2012, a 1.3% rental market vacancy rate amongst market rate units. So the study identified some needs in terms of market rate housing, roughly 200 units over the next 5 years, some tax credit housing, some subsidized rental for the lowest income families. Senior housing is pretty stable. There's been some new developments that have gone on in that community, so there really isn't a new need to take on more there. And then on owner-occupied units, there's a real need for development of homeownership units as well. There currently is a 40-unit market rate project that's just about ready to be fully funded and get started this spring. And there is a 24-unit tax credit project that's in the planning stages, hopefully to go into this next round of applications. In that 2010 market area, the data from 2010, there's about 23,000 people, 23,600. And Thief River Falls is a community of 8,500. And Pennington County at the center of it is about 14,000 people. So these are not large areas in terms of population density. Roseau County includes the cities of Roseau and War Road. Greenbush and Badger are the major communities in Roseau County. Their homeownership rate's about 80%, almost 81, a little under 20% rental, and their vacancy rate amongst all rental units is 2.4%, another very tight housing market. And I think a very interesting thing about Roseau County, the second major housing type is a mobile home in this county, which they're both in parks, and they're also just scattered around in scattered site areas on 5 acres, 10 acres, et cetera. They've got a real need for market rate rental as well, affordable rental, 67 units of affordable rental units are needed in the next 8 years. Senior housing is also pretty stable. They really don't need any new development there, but the market kind of has taken care of that already. And then there's a real need for owner-occupied units there as well. So that's some of the data. And what do we hear in this planning process? Well, the major employers in these communities are growing. On Thief River Falls, you've got DigiKey. You have Arctic Cat. DigiKey is adding people, new employees, every month. And they've expressed a real challenge in trying to attract new workers, sometimes highly technological workers and other times just entry-level workers, and finding a place to stay. So increasingly people are traveling from further distances to actually arrive to work there for starting jobs that are starting with good wages, $12, $13 an hour in many cases. And it's just not enough to be a living wage and support a family, but it's a great starting wage. So there's kind of this need for a housing spectrum that needs a little bit of help to get started but can't quite afford the market rate type rentals. So I think that this $10 million initiative would actually really target this population, both in the Thief River Falls and Roseau area, this kind of whole region, to really get the market started to help support the growth there. I think many of these employees, including Polaris, Marvin Windows and Doors, have said we're thinking about growing, but we're concerned to grow here, we're going to need to have more housing for people so that we can, you know, keep people here in our community and not have long commutes, such long commutes, really provide those opportunities as we can. So I think the communities have worked well to try to understand what their situation is, what their need is, and now they're really poised for action. They really would like to, they're really asking the question of how can we get some help here to get started. And I think Commissioner Tingerthal mentioned the meeting next Tuesday up in Roseau in the afternoon, late afternoon, when the governor will be there, and Commissioners Tingerthal and Clark Sieben from Deed will also be there to really kind of engage in some conversation with the community about ways there can be partnerships developed and increase that housing development in those communities. So that's my kind of quick story, and I would love to entertain any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you for bringing that to the committee. Representative O'Neill, a question?
Thank you, Chairwoman. Thank you for the work that you do. I have quite a bit of family that lives up there. I'm originally from northern Minnesota and have family that work at DigiKey. My brother is actually an executive at Marvin Windows. I have lots of different classmates and so on that work in the area. So my question is based on that after many conversations with family and friends up there. I know DigiKey is growing and I understand that because I hear that all the time that they don't have housing and they don't have that. But Marvin Windows has struggled tremendously. You know, obviously they're related to the housing debacle and they're just starting to come back to life again. But last I checked in with my brother and a few other people that actually work there, they hadn't, even the employees they had weren't even back to completely full-time work because they cut them down to 30, 32 hours, which President Obama had talked about, this great company that had basically, you know, cut their workforce. They kept their workforce, but they cut their hours way down. And I have some good classmates that are brilliant people that were barely making it because they were, you know, down to 30 hours a week instead of 40. So I understand the side on Thief River Falls, but you have to convince me just a little bit about Marvin Windows. And are they, so they've actually told you they're ready to expand? I'm just really questioning that.
I think what Marvin Windows has said in our planning process is that there, as they think about the future and when the market and the housing market comes back, they certainly anticipate getting back to their normal rate, and they're really trying to look ahead. They know that it takes a while to get housing projects going, and while they don't have an immediate need today to hire more workers, perhaps maybe they need to get people back on their 40-hour shifts, I would guess. I think the driver for growth at today in that county, in Roseau County, is really Polaris, who has actually said, we want to expand. We're at the point we'd like to do that right now, but we're very concerned about not having places for people to live that are in this growth. And I think Marvin has been supportive of that, has been at the table. But no, I don't believe that they've said it publicly in those meetings, we want to grow right now, but they actually are thinking of the future is what they've said.
And a follow-up?
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, so I'm also a subcontractor, so we build stuff. And actually, Representative Hurtado over there has been a developer for, 30, 35 years? Can you explain the thought process? Why don't we have private developers go? I mean, I would think if I was a private developer and I knew that there was a huge need for housing, I'd be up there and building stuff. I don't understand why public dollars need to be invested. Can you explain that to me, the difference? Because, you know, he and I come from the private sector, and I think Representative Hurtado would probably hightail it up there and start building stuff if that was a tremendous need there.
Mr. Vandewall.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think that's a great question. From the amount of time that I've spent there, and I'm not from there, so I don't have the history, but I think that what I've heard from developers is that there's been such a cycle of business over the years of up and down that there have been projects that have not done very well, housing projects in the past. So I think there's been a reluctance for developers to jump in and take on this need at this point in time. There are, in the Thief River Falls area, there are at least two market rate rental developers actively engaged, so working on projects, and there are a couple at least that have begun to have some interest in the Roseau County area. So my guess would be, and it's just a guess, but I would say there's been some history that has kind of kept developers away, and with the downturn in the market, you know, developers haven't been flocking anywhere to really start a lot of projects until they can know that they're going to be fully funded and supported.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, that's because a lot of the developers went out of business. I mean, a lot of them are not flocking anywhere because, well, maybe they're in the Dakotas, but a lot of my trades friends have just flat out gone out of business and gone elsewhere. But so if the market is unstable, then you have to still convince me why government dollars, why public money is a good idea there if we have such a fluctuation of employment and housing and... I'm just trying to wrap my mind around why would that be a good investment for us, for the public dollars then?
Well,
Mr.
I think Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think I may not have all the arguments. I really came today to kind of talk about, you know, my experience and what I've seen in terms of the planning. As I've driven through the communities, I've seen a lot of substandard housing in terms of manufactured mobile homes. I think that's a huge issue to address there. And I think in the way that this has been kind of proposed to be a challenge grant, where you've got major employers that are talking about need, and this is really the opportunity where that they can partner with these public resources to really create what's needed in that area. So I think that public-private partnership is a good argument, is a strong argument to stimulate the market and get it going. It's a one-time add-on, as far as I understand, to the Challenge Grant Program, so it's really meant to be a bit of a stimulus to get it started.
Sorry, one more. Thank you. Thank you, Chair, for indulging me.
No problem.
And then, so can you tell me the numbers that DigiKey, Articap, Polaris, because I know Marvin's not expanding. That I know. But the other three, have they given you some solid numbers of if there was housing available, they would hire X number of employees?
At this point in the planning,
Vandewell?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, at this point in the planning, I haven't seen full numbers from them. From DigiKey, I've understood that they're hiring anywhere from 50 to 60 new employees a month net. They have some turnover too. But as in the course of a year, they're adding 600 jobs. And for the last several years, they've been adding jobs at that rate. I haven't seen numbers from Polaris and for Marvin, because we just really kind of got started in their planning process. So our real planning process is about to kick off in that area, where we would get into more details of those nature, of that nature, and get into more of that fact.
And I would like to respond to one of Representative O'Neill's questions.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
And that's about private developers and workforce housing and affordable housing. And we have a number of those private developers in Minnesota on our board. And yes, they do require a lot of financing, such as the low-income housing tax credit and bonding, in order to raise the equity that they need to build housing that is affordable to the residents of the certain area that they're serving. And we love to set up a meeting with you, with one of those private developers, so we can talk about that more. Thank you.
And let me just say, Representative O'Neill, over the years, the Challenge Fund has really developed because businesses asked to be partnering with the state government in order to be able to help the businesses expand and to be able to pay the wages that they do. So it's really, you know, in a way, a business subsidy that hopefully is very good for that region. And we can hear more about that, I guess, in the future. I think Representative Hertas, you had a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add on Representative O'Neill's comments that, you know, much of the problem we have in the business community is the general malaise and lack of economic security to provide the jobs in the first place. And as once mentioned before by Representative Mariani, I think we should be going after policies that serve a broad and general good. When a program starts to provide an opportunity for a large company in a single diverse industry to have a place at the table to provide low-cost housing for its workers, to me corrupts the market force of paying higher wages to attract the people to produce their product. And so if this were a general diverse economy where these types of resources could be expended because it serves the general purpose and the general good rather than someone who has a place at the table, I'm behind it. But to have a snowmobile manufacturer or a window manufacturer or any isolated plant have a competitive advantage over its competitor by having low-cost housing so they can have low wages is the wrong direction. And that's my comment.
Representative Isaacson, I think you're going to get the last word here.
Oh, Lovely. Thanks for your testimony today. I really appreciate it. And I just would like to highlight something that maybe this fits within a larger context. I'm on the Jobs Committee, and Representative Mahoney said there's an easy 50,000 manufacturing jobs that are going unfilled. And I thought that number was pretty fantastically high until I started talking to manufacturing companies about the serious shortage they have in bringing in workers into the rural area. And so it is instances like this that I think that your work is properly, correctly placed, and I appreciate what I'm seeing with that and want to continue exploring what these options are and see how we can replicate that elsewhere. I would share the concerns of Representative Hertas regarding the wage side of that, but I think right now when we're facing a crisis in the workforce, it's more important for us right now to be providing every infrastructure advantage we can to any company that needs it to be successful so more people are working, more people are paying taxes. So I appreciate what you guys are bringing to the table and would moderately disagree with my esteemed colleagues on some of the assessments they've made regarding the efficacy of your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sorry that we're out of time, but I'm really pleased that you came, and I think it's the beginning of a very good discussion that will be continued. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Committee members, the meeting is adjourned.